Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, stream our show at nprnews.org/listen live every weekday at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. And if you make a habit of listening to our 9 a.m. show, thank you very much. That's our show today, The Science of Habits. And I have an analogy that I think may make some sense as our discussion takes shape. It occurred to me that living through this pandemic is like being on the inside of one of those Jiffy Pop pans. You remember those flat pans that turn into a big silver bubble as you hold it over the stove. Now inside, those little corn kernels are exploding, first a couple, then a whole bunch all together. That's what this pandemic feels like to me, surprise after surprise after surprise going off. And as you'll see in this conversation, our brains don't love all those surprises. So as our guests join us, I want to hear from you. Were there some good habits that you struggled to hang on to during the pandemic? Were there some not-so-good habits that slipped in, despite all attempts to keep your good habits? Tell me how you've managed this. So did you start off kind of saying, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to be disciplined, and this is how this is going to go? And bit by bit, some of those good habits slipped beyond your grasp. Or maybe you've adopted some good habits as a result of the pandemic, and you're determined to hang on to them long after we're through this. Talk to me about the science of habits in your own personal experience this morning. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. And on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. Wendy Wood is with us, a professor of psychology and business at the University of Southern California, and the author of Good Habits, Bad Habits, The Science of Making Positive Changes That Stick. And she's with us today from Washington, D.C. Professor Wood, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Katie Milkman is with us, a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and the author of the upcoming book, How to Change, The Science of Getting from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be, and with us today from Philly. And Professor Milkman, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you. Great to be here, and particularly with one of my favorite other academics. Lovely to hear Wendy's voice, too.
Good. Sounds like you know each other. That's a good thing. So, Professor Milkman, feel free to disavow my Jiffy Pop analogy. But I'm telling you, this has come to my mind a number of times over the pandemic. It's like revelation after then the thing we have to get used to. This just feels like it's one thing after the other since last February and March. What do you think?
I agree with you. It's a lot. And one of the ways that we tend to react when we're overwhelmed with a lot of extreme events is actually by becoming more numb to them. So we start to do what's called hedonically adapt, and we think, oh, okay, it's not as bad as it seems. And that's not great in a situation like this, actually, because it means you're not necessarily reacting to the news as effectively as you would if you took it as seriously as you should. It's a tough time.
You use the term hedonically adapt. Okay, what is that?
That's the nerd term for basically getting used to extreme circumstances. So a really fascinating thing about the way our minds work is that when we face a really good event, like winning the lottery, or we come and face a really bad event, right? Like living through a pandemic or losing a loved one, or even, facing some horrible injury. Either way, our body and our mind are good at actually adapting and going back to sort of where we were before within a pretty short period of time. Often research shows that within like half a year, we're back to our old state of happiness, even after experiencing something truly extreme. And,
wow.
And so what that means is that we also seem to be adapting, at least this is my observation, I'm curious if Wendy agrees, to all of this news that's coming in and sort of becoming numb to it. When this sort of extreme event happens, our body says, okay, and our mind says, I can't get too crazy. I have to go back to normal somehow, and starts to tune out.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Professor Wood, I've experienced that. I've heard from people who are saying, you know, these cataclysmic kind of events, I know I should feel more about them, but somehow I feel a little detached. Is that what Professor Milkman's describing? You agree with that?
Yes. Katie's absolutely right with this. There is a phenomenon, habituation, that is adaptive in a way, because we can't keep responding to all of the negative information we get continually with horror and fear. Instead, over time, we do, as Katie described, adapt to it. But there's a bad side to this too, which is that it reduces our feeling of fear. So we stop reacting perhaps as protectively as we should. We stop taking the measures that we should, because we start viewing this as more the new normal. And when you're in a pandemic situation, that's not an adaptive response. So it helps us in the short term, but it also can expose us to more risk.
Okay, so Professor Wood, I think I hear you saying that detachment might be in some ways a protective measure. I mean, I think we saw this with mask wearing for a while, right? We got used, it seemed weird at the beginning, it was hard to get used to, and then things kind of slipped away as we began, let's say in the early fall, to see these cases, these COVID cases rise, but not perceive the threat as intense as it was last March. Does that fit into what you're saying?
Yes, it does. I think that a lot of us were really, we were really shaken by the introduction of the virus. And there was broader support initially for some of the shutdowns than we've seen more recently, when actually the virus data are worse. So things just keep getting worse, but our behavior, we've sort of become inured to it, and we're not responding as you might expect.
This makes sense. Let's go to the phones. We have a number of callers on the line. If you've just tuned in, we're talking about the science of habits, how our habits, maybe the good ones, have been disrupted. Well, maybe the bad ones too. I'm hearing from some of you on Twitter about that. Have been disrupted by the pandemic. What the neuroscience, what the psychology is of habits, and I'm asking you whether there were some good habits that you really struggled to hang on to. When my routine for exercise got disrupted, I really struggled for a few months about when to fit it in and why to even bother. Maybe there were some not so good habits for you that you let go and replaced with a good habit. How about that? 651-227-6000 to the phones, to Patrick in Maplewood. Hi, Patrick. Good to have you on the phone line.
Good morning. Good morning, Carrie Miller. Appreciate
what's
being
your, what's
able
your story?
To come in. Pardon me?
What's your story, Patrick?
I agree with particularly what you were just saying. You know, my gym closed down in March. I was used to going 2-3 times a week, teaching martial arts, working out on the machines, keeping a routine going, and everything closed down. It was also my social network with the students I was teaching. And I was just despondent for a couple of months there. I watched all these other social interactions go down, and like you say, is it even worth it? You know, I found myself just being despondent. But I'd like to say, just as a little insert here, is that I also felt myself getting very cheap and tight with my money. And so as November and Give to the Max Day, I started thinking about, are these deductible charitable contributions? But I have You know, and this isn't that great of a pitch, but NPR, I renewed my subscription and I made an extra donation, and I have other, you know, places that I thought about not, you know, holding back on the money. But it's like, you know, there's this bigger, greater world out there. And if I have the means, why not?
Yeah. Hey, thank you for that.
You bet. Come, you know, as Gary Eichten once said during the pledge week, it's like, you know, if you don't contribute, you're borrowing the newspaper from your neighbor's steps and cutting out the coupons and then putting it back. And that convinced me that I should become a sustaining member. Anyway, come August, I started biking every day. I've got my bike up on a trainer in the basement, and I just know that if I don't go do that for 15, 20 minutes, I get my stretches in. That's my meditation period. My wife and I have been trying to get out for walks every day, even when it's a little bit wet and slippery. And I do that just because I know how good it feels, you know. I embrace that well-being.
So, Patrick, you are bringing up something that I wanted to bring back to Professor Milkman, which is, you know, I think when you're in a routine, the incentive of the habit is pretty clear. Hey, maybe this is a day I don't really want to ride the Peloton in my basement, but I know it makes me feel good. There's something about the disruption of the world around us that I think, you know, causes that incentive to slip away. What's that all about?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, Wendy and I have both actually studied this in different ways, how disruptions in the world can shift our routines. I've studied what I call temporal landmarks, or moments that sort of stand out from the other day-to-day minutia that's going on. So they could be something like New Year's or a birthday. It could be the news of a pandemic or an impeachment, anything that makes a day feel special. And there's two things that happen. They separate us in time. They make us feel like, oh, this is a different era. Like, that was the old me before today. This is a new me. And that has two implications. One, if you weren't killing it with your habits before, you sort of feel like you have a clean slate and a clean break and you can start over. But actually, if you're doing really well, it can be disruptive because, again, it feels like a break and whatever momentum you have has been disrupted. And so I've studied the sort of psychological way that happens. And Wendy has also studied how actual disruptions, not just things we read about in the news or look at on the calendar, can shape our habits. So she may want to add something about that, too.
Before we do that, Katie, I want to ask you about how, you know, a temporal landmark to me, as you've said, seems like let go of 2020, you know, don't let the door hit you. Hey, it's 2021. But what we've discovered is the bad news and the bad stuff followed us right into 2021. So that temporal landmark doesn't seem to, maybe we had higher expectations than we should have had around it. Yes?
Well, yeah, we didn't have the fresh start we were all hoping for. It felt like it lasted about 6 days. and then the Capitol raid sort of, you know, washed all hope away of a fabulous new year. It's true, you know, there's not a lot that can be done about that. I think we lost out on our magical fresh start of 2021. And it is always an illusion anyway, right? It's just a day like any other day on the calendar. it's just a trick our minds play on us. By the way, that's very helpful. It's a helpful trick because most of the time we could use a clean slate. We could use some disruption to help us set aside whatever we failed to do and become more optimistic. But the good news is actually, even though New Year's didn't turn out to be such a great fresh start, a long-lasting and inspiring moment, there's always other ones to look forward to, right? So every Monday is a minor fresh start. It turns out people are more motivated to pursue their goals at the start of a new week, a new month. We've got February coming up when we celebrate birthdays. The day you get your vaccine is going to feel like a fresh start. So there's a lot of other ones we can hook our hope onto. And even though New Year's let us down, I'm optimistic that we'll find other moments in the coming months that we can use to build new goals and start better habits and sort of get off of any bad tracks we've gotten onto.
Okay. Call here from John in Minneapolis. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Carrie. Sure. I'm very curious about, I have what I've never been diagnosed per se from a professional, But I know I have addictive tendencies. And one thing, since I've been unemployed with the COVID situation, I've recalled over the course of this time, I sort of got into drinking more beer. And then I realized that I was sort of getting addicted to it. Like, time of day was pretty consistent. And then, like, I never drank more than three. But then I realized, oh, I'm drinking too much. And so I was like, maybe I'll just drink one glass of bourbon. And it was weird to have the experience of sort of understanding that I have this penchant for addiction, and actually, like, in real time, watching it play out. So I'm curious, before we knew about these disorders, sort of from a scientific point of view, what is sort of the history of how people came to terms with some of those behaviors that we could call habits, but what part did addiction play, and how is that changing now that we know more brain science? Thank you.
Good question. Wendy Wood, it's a big one too. Will you tackle this a bit?
Sure. I would say that our habits are very dependent on the environment. And I think what John is describing is an experience of having alcohol available without the usual limits on our drinking, right? We usually have to be at work. We have to be at a certain place at a certain time. We are held accountable more for our actions than we are now during the pandemic. And that takes some of the constraints off of our behavior, so that we are actually having to make decisions in contexts that are very different from our normal everyday life. And that can lead to some excesses. It can also lead people to curb their behavior in new ways. So to go back to your metaphor, Carrie, about corn popping, I think that this, I agree with you completely that this whole pandemic has been exposing us to new and new situations that we are able to eat outside during the summer in restaurants, but then that closes down, and then we right. are all stuck inside by ourselves. So we are being, we're experiencing a whole variety of new contexts that keep shifting on us, but none of them are like where we started from in February or March. And those influences of our environment are very important for the habits we form. So we tend to form habits that are easy within the context that we're living. Mm-hmm. And one way to control unwanted behavior or unwanted habits is to actually put friction, what we call friction, on that behavior, making it more difficult. And for an analogy, you can think of anti-smoking campaigns. So we knew for a long time that smoking was a health risk. But people only seriously started to quit when the government made it more difficult for us to smoke. They taxed cigarettes. They banned smoking in public places. They took advertising off the air, and you can no longer buy cigarettes, right, just by picking them up off the store shelf. You actually have to ask someone when you want to purchase cigarettes. So all of these things made it more difficult to smoke. They added friction and vastly reduced smoking rates from 50% down to 15%, and interrupted people's habits. So we can use some of those same techniques in controlling our own behavior and try to put some restrictions or constraints on those behaviors while we're in the pandemic.
So, Katie, this question occurs to me, given what John asked and then what Wendy said. Are habits consistent choices day to day, like it's another day and this is my habit, but I'm going to make a choice to do it? Or are they choices that become, you know, easier, less specific, I guess, the longer you hang on to them? You see what I'm asking?
I do, yeah. I think the research suggests you're not making sort of a decision every time. Once something begins to feel like a habit, this is essentially the definition of a habit. You stop consciously debating, should I have coffee this morning? Or, should I smoke this cigarette? And it starts to just be a thing you do without thinking and deliberately, you know, debating. And so that is one of the reasons it's so hard to disrupt them, because you're not doing this cost-benefit analysis each time you might engage in the behavior. Instead, you're just following an intuition or an instinct instinct is something you're born with, but it feels like an instinct after you've built a habit. It's just your natural response.
From Twitter, a listener says, once only a cup or two of coffee a day, now a pot of coffee. Another listener says, I quit biting my fingernails for fear of getting the virus. At 63 years old, I finally have long, pretty nails. And to the phones to Tesla in Winona. Hi, so glad you waited.
Hey, Carrie, thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you on the line. So tell me your story.
Yeah, so I actually developed a really positive habit, but also a negative one as well. So I made it a habit as soon as the pandemic started and I was able to be home more often. I made it a habit of getting up early before the kids woke up and having a cup of coffee and reading an inspiring book. And so that's kind of actually played out really well for it's really helped my mental health. And I have like these meditative cards that I do. So I have this little routine. And I actually started reading at night. So in the morning, I'm reading an inspiring like self-help book or just an inspiring book. And at night, I'm reading my novel. And so that's really, really genuinely helped my mental health and has allowed me to start the day and especially have more patience, which is something I need more of these days with the added stress of the pandemic and all these different changes and everything else all on top of our plates. So I've actually noticed that if I'm not able to get that in, it really starts my day off in a not so awesome way. My patience cup, as we talk about in my household, my patience cup or our patience cup is not as full as it could be. That's definitely helped and been an awesome thing that I hope to continue on after the pandemic started. But on the negative side, I've been having a glass of wine every day.
So. Just one? Oh, come on. Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah. It's not all one and a half, but and that's not something that I would have normally done. Normally it would have been like a glass of wine at the end of the week or something like that. But now I'm finding myself like having one every day. So, and that's something that I hope to tackle, or will probably tackle like after the pandemic and everything. And I'm trying to give myself that slack of not trying to be perfect. Because I feel like, especially right now, we have to make sure that we're not trying to be perfect or put ourselves up on unrealistic expectations, and allow ourselves a small amount of vice. But
you sound like you've really got a real handle on this. Habit. Yeah, I mean, you sound to me like you've really got a good handle on this. But Katie, I wondered, is it going to be, I mean, Tesla has initiated this new habit, the meditative time, the reading in the morning, and she's getting, good things that are flowing from that. So this kind of brings us back to this incentive thing that I was asking about. Does this mean that it will be easier to flow whenever this happens out of the pandemic and hang on to a habit like that?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question. By the way, I love that habit. That's a great habit. I'm sort of jealous. I don't read fast enough to get in a whole book before my son gets up in the morning, but I'm very impressed. It's absolutely the case that the more instantly gratifying a behavior is, the stickier it is. And so I think the fact that you're getting so much joy from this habit suggests it's more likely that you'll be able to have it carry over. But it's certainly going to be more of a challenge to carry it over after the pandemic is over than it is to sort of carry it over from today to tomorrow, because your situation is going to change. I don't know what your life looks like, but if you suddenly have to go back to a commuting job, for instance, or if your kids are at home now for school and now you have to get them shipped off either to the bus or drive them somewhere, that is going to disrupt what's working for you. And so you are going to have to be more thoughtful about how you maintain, what's your plan, what are the ways you're going to adjust to ensure you can still do these things that you value, as opposed to being able to just assume it will naturally continue.
This is a show about the psychology and the science of habits with Katie Milkman. She's a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and Wendy Wood, a provost professor of psychology and business at the University of Southern Cal. This has been really great to hear about the habits that you've brought into your life during the pandemic, the habits that you know, the good ones that you struggled to hang on to and that maybe they've slipped away a bit during the pandemic. What are you learning about yourself as you kind of wrestle with the habits you want to hang on to and the habits that are creeping in? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Wendy, before we go to the phones here, I was reading some of the stuff you've written about weight loss and a cousin as an example. And this applies, I think, to a lot of people who say, it's the new year. This is my now good new habit. I'm going to eat healthy and I'm going to lose weight. What you write about is that the weeks go on and it gets tougher. Your cousin kind of went silent with these big declarations of how well it was going, right?
Well, I do think this is how many of us try to change our behavior. We make a decision, we make a commitment, we're strong people, we think we have enough willpower to achieve it. But particularly with weight loss, it's a real challenge because we often use the strategy of denying ourselves. And that's something my cousin did, is deciding I'm not going to eat things that are not good for me. And that denial itself is counterproductive. Psychological research has shown that there's sort of an ironic feature to controlling our behavior. And you may have had this experience, or some of your listeners may, that when you make a decision not to do something, I'm not going to eat things that are bad for me, you start to think about it and you become more obsessed with it, so that you actually focus on it more than you did before you made the decision to control your behavior. And that's counterproductive. That gets in our way. There are better ways to lose weight, to control our behavior, that don't have to do with that self-denial and white-knuckling it through. Instead, they have to do with controlling our environment. And that's what I tried to explain in the book, that habits, ingrained habits like eating, are hard to change through self-control. Instead, you have to make more fundamental changes that are actually easier, but that affect our behavior more than our commitment or our decisions.
Right. Makes sense. Listener says on Twitter, my great habit that I've developed is sobriety. I've been sober curious for a long time, and I love it. It's helping me with everything else. Lowers anxiety during a terribly anxious time. To the phones to Marcia in Robbinsdale. Marcia, it sounds like you started off well and then things kind of slipped from your grasp. Is that right?
Yeah. Like
how did it happen?
Well, I started with this exercising and I was doing it. I exercise a lot anyway. I like to exercise, but I was on this little program. I did 74 days and every single day exercise. Didn't miss a day.
Good.
And then I retired from my job around July, and I got a new part-time job that's easier and less stress. But then all these other things added into my life that were kind of peripheral, but now became more central. And my whole everything just discombobulated, and I've lost that exercise piece, which is really bad because I know I need it. So
you need it, yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. So, you know, I keep telling myself I'm going to get back to it, and I just haven't. And so it's just kind of one of those weird things. Started out really good, and then 74 days, that's enough time to build a habit, right?
I know, that's really good. Okay, so Marcia, here's the question I think for Katie that comes out of your experience, which is, when Katie, can you anticipate this? So Marcia retires from her job. She's going into part-time work. Can you, in some ways, if you have a habit that is really working for you, anticipate the disruption, and what can you do?
Yeah, it's a great question. And ideally, yes, you can anticipate it, because science, a lot actually by Wendy, has shown that this kind of change in your life, in your circumstances, can be very disruptive to habits. So, you know, there's evidence that this is coming. And then the question is, yeah, how do you behave if you know it's coming? How can you ensure that the disruption doesn't wreck your habit? And I think the best answer I can give is to be extremely deliberate about planning how you will create a new routine in this new era of your life. So whatever it was that was happening before, right? Either you could say, I'm going to just carry forth with that. I'm not going to let this disruption change it. But that might be hard, because maybe your hours have changed and you no longer have sort of the cue of, I get off work at 5:00. And that's exactly when I step onto the exercise bike, for instance, would be one habit.
Right.
And now work ends at noon. And like, that feels too early to exercise. And then by 5:00, I've already had a lot of snacks and I'm not feeling it. And I really want my glass of wine. So if you know what the change is going to be, then you need to make a concrete plan. When then are you going to do your exercise? How are you going to do it? And what are you going to do to make it enticing so that it doesn't feel like a chore at this new phase of life? Because making sure that you really enjoy what you're doing is part of the key to ensuring that it's going to become sticky. And if you were doing it before because you'd built a habit, but you weren't really loving it, then these disruptions are more likely to be problematic. So a lot of research suggests if we can find ways to make workouts fun, for instance, I do it by doing something I call temptation bundling. I only let myself listen to my favorite audiobooks. So lowbrow, fast-paced fiction. And I only get to hear what happens next when I step onto a treadmill or an elliptical. If you can find something that makes your workouts fun, it could be you meet a friend with your masks on outside, but you guys get to chat while you run 6 feet apart. You know, making it social is one way to make it fun. Tying it with the other activities that you enjoy, like binge watching TV shows or listening to a favorite podcast, whatever it is, you need to find some way to make that enjoyable and have a plan. When are you going to do it in this new era? Those are the things I think that set you up for success.
So Wendy, you know, as Katie's describing this, I'm thinking, now, is this a strategy where maybe a little bit of denial could be incentivizing? Like, I am not going to have that glass of wine at 5:00 until I get that exercise in between 2 and 4. Does that work? Can you kind of trick yourself into that?
Well, you can certainly trick yourself into, as Katie was describing, only enjoying a certain reward while you're doing a behavior that meets your goals. And that reward is important for two reasons. One is you're just simply more likely to repeat a behavior that you enjoy, that's rewarding in some way, than a behavior that you don't like so much. So that's one reason why it's really important to figure out ways to make it rewarding. But there's another reason too, and that is that with rewards, our brain releases a neurochemical called dopamine. And dopamine has lots of different uses in the brain, lots of different functions. But one of the things it does is it ties together habit memories. So it ties together what you're doing in a given context that got you a reward.
Hmm.
And that helps the habit to form. So rewards are important both because they increase repetition and also because they facilitate habit formation. They're a catalyst to you forming a habit in your mind so that you can do the behavior automatically and it takes less thought and decision.
Super interesting.
It just becomes part of your routine.
Right. Call here from Troy in Boulder, Colorado. Hi, Troy. Glad you're listening in this morning and you had a chance to call.
Hello. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. This is great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what I'm wondering is I've noticed that even when the external phenomenon in my life is great, you know, I live in Boulder, Colorado. It's sunny. It's beautiful. Even when things are great, sometimes I'm not happy. But sometimes when things are miserable, I'm still content. So it seems like happiness is not always dependent on external phenomena. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering, what's the distinction between hedonia, or being kind of on a hedonic treadmill of generating sort of your happiness and your habits, to having a dimension of consciousness where you're more content without the stimulus? You know, how can we go more towards having happiness without dependent on external phenomena?
Hmm. And then how does that affect kind of your willingness to cultivate good habits?
Yeah, the habit of not being dependent on, you know, being healthy.
Yeah,
or,
got it.
You know, I went through a divorce this year, all the external phenomena going on, you know, with the political system and the pandemic. You know, there's so many things I can't control. And so I'm wondering, is there a way to be content irregardless of what's happening around me?
Okay. Katie, we could probably do a whole hour just on that question, but what would you say?
It's a wonderful question. You know, one of the things that's really interesting about happiness is how often people misconceive of what makes them happy. And it turns out the most important things are not necessarily, you know, whether or not you pick up the newspaper and see a good or a bad headline, or you know, what the weather is. We overweight, in fact, how much good weather will affect our happiness. Lots of people think Californians must be much happier than Midwesterners because they think about the difference in weather. But it's really other things that matter much more. The things that matter to our happiness are we exercising? That's a really big one, right? Are you getting physical activity? Are you surrounded by a network of friends and loved ones who support you and make you feel good every day? Are you doing work that feels meaningful to you? Are you investing in experiences that are memorable and exciting, more than things that are not going to bring you nearly as much happiness as you anticipate? So there's just wonderful research suggesting that we can do a lot more to make ourselves happy if we're more strategic about our decisions. One book that actually came out earlier this year that I would recommend is by Ashley Willens, and I think it's called Time Happy, if I'm remembering correctly.
Time Happy? Okay.
I might have that wrong. I feel like I should be Googling this. But Ashley Willens from Harvard Business School, and she's an expert on happiness whose work I would definitely recommend looking at for suggestions. And then the Happiness Podcast with Lori Santos is another wonderful one, and she also has an online course. And both of them are great scientists who really do a brilliant job of explaining some of the misconceptions we have about what truly creates happiness and suggesting ways that we can use research to make choices that will increase our happiness.
Let me ask you this about exercise, though, because we've talked with Emily Nagoski a number of times about how stress interferes with I guess the perception of happiness, actually, now that we're talking about that. And she talks about completing the stress cycle and how essential this is for women. So when stress is building, some kind of move, you've got to get out and do some kind of movement, whether it's hardcore exercise or just getting out for a walk, because for women, completing that cycle is really essential. So I guess I'm wondering how stress intersects with the development or the persistence of habits. Katie, you feel like you could answer that?
I want to pass that to Wendy because I think her neuroscience background will make her better.
You got it. Wendy, as I was asking, I figured that's for you. Okay.
Yes, happy to answer it. So what stress does is it takes up space in our minds, and it saps our energy to make decisions. And that is exactly what stress feels like it does. In this case, mm-hmm. that's exactly what it does, is it makes it difficult for us to make decisions and to effortfully decide. So what we do instead is we tend to fall back on our habits. And if you have habits to exercise already, then it's going to make it more likely that you do so, simply because you're not making decisions to do something else. Instead, you're just responding automatically to the cues around you, as you always have. And that's a habitual response. The problem comes in, of course, when we have a number of bad habits that we don't control when we're stressed, simply because we're less able to. And we're more likely to engage in those bad habits under stress than when we're not stressed. So our good habits become really useful refuges when mm-hmm. we're stressed, but our bad habits also surface, and that's the challenge.
Okay. The book, by the way, that Katie was talking about by Ashley Willens is called Time Smart, How to Reclaim Your Life and Live a Happier Life. To Kelly in Minneapolis. Hi, Kelly. Glad you waited.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. What's your story?
I guess some of my background, I play competitive roller derby for North Star in Minneapolis, and I was
That's
on
great.
The... Yeah, and I was on the travel team, and actually the pandemic hit right as we were getting ready to go to our first tournament out in Boston. And in the before times, I was, you know, probably at practice 3 nights a week, doing powerlifting in the mornings 3 days a week plus cardio on top of that, and just felt like at a very, like, high level of performance. Mm-hmm. And for me, since the pandemic hit, it's just, like, without something necessarily to, like, train for, it's been hard. Like, I've done mountain biking a few days a week over the summer, and then this winter I've kind of been doing snowboarding a few days a week, but it's just kind of hard to feel that, like, soreness and that, like, I don't know, hard training without something that you're, like, striving towards, you know? And I'm kind of
right.
wondering,
yeah,
I guess, what do you do? Like,
so this is a really good question. So Katie, what if the goal isn't like right in front of you? I've got that game. I've got that competition. I have that. That's why I'm doing all of this. What if it's much longer term? How do you keep up the motivation?
It's a fantastic question, and it's one of the biggest problems that I think becomes a barrier. So there's a few things. One, research shows that if you can break down that big distal goal and think about some bite-sized pieces and bite-sized sort of landmarks that you can put in your path, that can be really helpful. So for example, in one research study that I actually collaborated on, we found that when people had a big goal of, say, volunteering 200 hours a year, and it was simply reframed as 4 hours a week, people were much more likely to actually achieve more. And you can think about that in terms of sort of a big objective, too. Can you think about bite-sized objectives that are more proximal, that will be more motivating and instantly gratifying, because you can sort of hit that goal, check that box off, and say cha-ching. But I also want to just go back to what we talked about before, because it's so fundamental to all of this. We often think that having a big goal, something big that we care about that's in the distant future, is going to be enough, and we can just sort of grin and push through, and that's mm-hmm. wrong. What we need instead is to make sure that there's some joy that comes from the act, that there's some instant gratification associated with doing whatever it is that will get us to that big distant goal, because we're fundamentally wired to care about immediate rewards and to dramatically undervalue long-term rewards. And so it comes back to this principle, like, what can you do to make it fun and enjoyable right now to be pursuing that goal? So not only break it down and have earlier, landmarks that you can check off, but also figure out ways to ensure that what you're doing to pursue that goal is immediately gratifying.
Okay, so this is exactly what I was curious about, whether incrementalism can really be an ally. Can you say, yes, I've got this long-term goal, but most of the time I'm not going to think about that. What I'm going to do is add 10 minutes a day to my workout or 10 minutes a day to my meditative reading. I mean, can you kind of fool yourself in some ways by these little increments of doing the thing that maybe feels hard in the moment but adds up?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I guess I would say I would think of them not as little increments without the long-term goal, but recognizing that you're making progress every time you hit one of those sub-goals, you're getting there. And so you get the good feeling associated with, yeah, like I'm doing something that's towards this big thing that I do care about. So that big goal is important. That's the reason you're bothering to do it in the first place, but you're giving yourself a sense of progress and progress that feels meaningful because you can see you checked off a sub-goal. So that's the way I would think about it. Rather than ignoring the big goal and tricking yourself into something smaller, I'd say stay focused on the big goal and recognize that these smaller chunks you've bitten off, every time you accomplish one of them, you're getting closer, you're making progress, you should feel good, you should feel satisfied, and that's all part of the journey.
Wendy, I have about 2 minutes, but I wonder, you know all the psychology of this. Do you still struggle with this? Like, I know I should be doing this, but I don't want to.
Oh, we all do. That's human nature. It's a function of our neural structures that we have multiple neural systems in our brain. And we can want to do one thing, have one clear sense of a goal, and yet have a habit to do something else. So that's normal. That's human nature. People need to recognize that it's not a flaw. It's actually a feature of our neural system.
Good advice. Wendy Wood's book is called Good Habits, Bad Habits, The Science of Making Positive Changes That Stick. Wendy, thank you. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Katie Milkman's book is called How to Change, The Science of Getting from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be. And it comes out this spring, and we'll talk about it with Katie then. Katie, thank you. I look forward to chatting again. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I look forward to that too. It was a pleasure.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks for listening.